You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are all in three different European locations, Richard.
Trick question that was.
Well, I'm in the UK, you're in France, and Daniel is in Mallorca. Hopped across to Mallorca from the Berlin hub. What's the weather like there?
Lionel, Richie, is it me you're looking for?
Oh, dear.
I haven't had that for a while, a few years.
Good reason.
Hey? Yeah. The weather is, yeah, it's splendid in Mallorca. No rain, no clouds forecast for about a week and a half. So, yeah, very happy with that.
No clouds forecast.
No, I've actually clouds? For reasons which I will elaborate on later, I've been looking at websites today, weather reviews. It's very hard to find websites that tell you what the weather was like on a given day. Just remember, it could be a niche in the market for us, for the Cycling Podcast, weather review service.
Who'd be interested in looking that up, I wonder? A time traveler?
Conspiracy theorist? A cycling crash conspiracy theorist, possibly?
Well, I'm talking weather. I've been under the weather. I've had a bit of a cough and a sneezing, fits of sneezing as well. Yeah, if I was a pro rider, I'd have been postponing my season's debut on account of illness. It has implications for the podcast as well, because I need to voice some links for our forthcoming Friends of the Podcast special. And until my voice returns to normal, I can't really do that. So
that's holding up the episode.
It is holding up the episode. Yeah.
Oh,
unless you want to do them.
Can AI not do this yet? Can we not get a cloned version of Lionel Burney? Just your voice, just a voice box.
Robot Lionel Burney is sitting in the corner of my office here, but he's run out of batteries. I need to go and get a couple under the weather. Yeah, can't go and get a couple of AA batteries for robot Lionel Burney. Maybe that's the answer.
Couple of double A's, I like it. Not very high powered machine, the robot Lionel Burney.
It's quite realistic, low-fi. True to life. Yeah, very low-fi.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And just take them out and give them a rub when the voice starts to slow down. Yeah. Well, Lionel, in your news roundup, which you're about to give us, I think I'm looking forward to this. I'm just disappointed I can't see Daniel's face for the news about the latest kind of twist in the story of Tom Dumoulin's health, and more than his health, is kind of the internal workings of Tom Dumoulin.
Well, there's a couple of things that Daniel might wince at a bit here, because we'll kick off with a sort of corrections and clarifications corner.
Oh, no.
A good friend of the podcast, Xiaomo Xu, writes from China to say that it's the Tour of Qinghai Lake, Daniel, not Qinghai.
All right.
I've fallen foul of that one before, but it's the Tour of Qinghai Lake for future reference.
Thank you very much.
And
is that the Chinese branch of our pronunciation police?
It is indeed, yes. I'm not sure what rank, sort of lieutenant, I think, a sergeant maybe, I don't know. And a new friend of the podcast, Tony Gruden, who works for the Slovenian broadcaster, the national broadcaster, one of a few people to point out that Slovenia may well look a little bit like an east-facing pigeon, as you said last week, Daniel, but actually, in all seriousness, the Slovenians are very proud of the fact that the outline of the country is reminiscent of a sort of marching, striding chicken. So much so...
Well, you should have known that as our resident poultry correspondent. You've got chickens. Have you still got chickens?
I've got two chickens, yeah. Both of whom look like the outline of Slovenia.
Do you call them Pog and Rog?
Pog and Rog, yeah.
Maybe should do Pog and Rog. I don't want to give it away now. There's a little chicken-related snippet in my Slovenian package, which will be coming in possibly a couple of weeks' time, just as Pog and Rog are going to go sort of head-to-head in some races. We'll release that. I've been finding out a lot more about Slovenia. And sticking with Slovenia, Alex McIntosh wrote in this week to ask... to say that surely Pogacar, Pog, is riding Milan-San Remo this year so he can attack on the Poggio.
How did we miss that?
We did miss that.
So sloppy.
Doesn't quite so work sloppy. In... works better in print, doesn't it, than Anyway, on with the news. Richard, you mentioned Tom Dumoulin. Yeah,
before anybody writes in to say it's actually the Poggio.
Indeed, yes. That. Yeah, we do know that. On with the news. Tom Dumoulin has delayed his season start. He's had intestinal parasites. Rather than return to racing at Tirreno Adriatico next month, he wants to prioritise an altitude training camp and is more likely to come back at Itzulia in the Basque Country in early April. It will mean that he's been off the bike and out of competition for 10 months. Remember, he crashed at the Giro last year, made a brief comeback at the Dauphiné, but hasn't raced since June the 14th. So not the ideal start to the season for Tom Dumoulin, and won't appear in Jumbo-Visma colours until early April, by the looks of it.
Also a bit of a concern, chaps, when Stephen Kreiswijk has been taking a lot longer than he and his team expected to recover, fully recover from the knee injury that he sustained at the Vuelta last year, isn't he?
Yeah, well, a lot of weight may rest on Roglic in that case, who hasn't so far run into any difficulties. A few crashes to report on. Well, Andre Greipel, worse luck, really, worse timing for us. We were promoting Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton interview with Andre Greipel, which is a fascinating listen. If you haven't listened to that, do go back and check that out. It's on the Cycling Podcast feed now. But just as we were releasing that episode, news broke that Andre Greipel crashed in training. He was out with Rick Zabel, and wheels seemed to slip, and down he went onto the curb, and he's had to have an operation on his shoulder and will be out of racing action until early May as well. Sticking with shoulder related issues, Laura Kenny crashed at the final round of the World Track Cup last month, but she will be able to take part in the World Championships in Berlin, which start next week, despite postponing an operation. So she's going to race still with the injury healing itself. Andre Amador has completed his long-awaited move from Movistar to Team Ineos and will make his debut at the UAE Tour in the coming days. Chris Froome's also going to make his return to racing there, we gather. But Amador's transfer, does that mean that the pastry chef no longer has any of his riders at Movistar? Movistar?
I think the pantry is bare, I think, as far as Movistar are concerned. I think, there's been a bit of a land grab or a croissant grab or something of that ilk. I don't know.
So he's moved all of the this is the pastry chef. The agent's name is Daniel
Giuseppe Acquadro.
That's right. And fallen out with Movistar and has been kind of gradually moving all of his riders out of the team, or they've been they've moved out one way or another.
Already had a lot of riders at Ineos, and the majority of the riders, well, a few of the riders that he had left at Movistar have now moved over to Ineos. And I think I'm correct in saying that he no longer has anyone at Movistar.
A couple of UCI rule changes that caught our eye in the past week, both of which we'll probably delve into in a little more detail later on. But one concerns sponsors that are involved in betting or gaming or lotteries, and it's been some regulation changes to tighten up. Mostly it seems to protect against conflicts of interest and the spectre of potential corruption. And another relating to gravel stages, off-road stages, in stage races, UCI stage races. The UCI has introduced some measures to basically give the teams more of a heads up on any sections that are taking riders off the beaten track in the interests of rider safety. The women's tour in June will start in Bicester. The rest of the route is to be announced in due course. And on to the racing, where it's been a very busy week or so in the road racing world. As the season gets into gear, we're going to talk about two races in particular today, the Columbia Tour and the Tour de la Provence in the south of France. But away from there, Shane Archbold of De Koninck Quickstep is the new Zealand road race champion. The Flying Mullet will be wearing the Silver Fern jersey when he returns back to race in Europe. The Vuelta de Murcia in Spain has been won overall by Sandro Murisa. Remember, he made quite a splash at the Tour de France last year and finished about 20 I think 20th overall, 20th or 21st overall.
One of your outside the team bus victims, was he not, Lionel?
He was, in the end, one of yours, wasn't he? Because I had a problem with 1T Group Gobert, as they were then, and you stepped in.
We did a bit of outside the team bus doping there that day, didn't we?
We did. You saved my blushes that day.
But he was a very interesting character, you know, really finding out about himself riding the tour last year.
Indeed, yeah, and well, he won overall in Murcia as well. The other stage was won by Luis Leon Sanchez of Astana. Astana did the 1-2 there, actually. Omar Fraile was second. And, well, Sanchez won the race in the past 2 years. Last year, it was a two-day stage race. The year before that, it was a one-day race. But Sanchez is keeping up quite an impressive record of having won a pro race every season for the past 14 seasons. There can't be many riders that can rival that. I'm sure somebody will write in and tell us if there's anyone sort of close to that or perhaps exceeding that. Can you think of anyone off the top of your head who's won a race a year every year for 14 years?
Well, probably Greipel. Although 14, perhaps not 14, actually. Greipel started winning around sort of 2007 time, didn't he? Yeah, maybe not, Napalm, maybe not. Did you chaps notice or see the news about Juan Miguel Mercado, former Tour de France stage winner today? He's been investigated for robberies in the Granada area. This has been covered in the local press in Granada. Tens of thousands worth of euros worth of cycling equipment has been stolen from, and I think houses have been burgled as well. Yeah, shades of Aitor Gonzalez. Remember Aitor Gonzalez, 2002 Vuelta winner, another rider of that, Spanish rider of that generation who had, I think he was arrested three or four times, once for beating someone up, once for fraud, and there was another attempted mobile phone theft or something along those lines. So, yeah.
Should just say Mercado has been investigated by police for an alleged involvement in criminal gang activity.
That's what I said, Napalm.
Nothing
That's
proven
what
so
I said.
Far. I'm just clarifying, Daniel. Just
double
making
clarifying.
Sure. Double clarifying. Better to be safe than sorry when it comes to people's guilt or innocence. Sticking with Spain, the Clásica Almería was won for the second year in a row by Pascal Ackermann, the German sprinter with Bora Hansgrohe. This is the it's the race of the greenhouses, isn't it, down there? It finishes in Roquetas de Mar on the coast.
Where we had a memorable conversation about croquetas once, didn't we?
Possibly we did, yeah.
In that neck of the woods. It was in that neck of the woods.
Unearthing another controversy where we said that croquetas were made of mashed potato and they're not. They're a thick bechamel sauce, except in cheap restaurants where they're sometimes substituted with the easier to freeze potato versions.
And neither do croquetas originate from roquetas, to be clear.
No, but the greenhouses are quite something, aren't they? And if you watch the racing in that area, and the Vuelta was there, 2 years ago, the greenhouses stretch for miles and miles. And in fact, when you look on like Google satellite view, it just looks, you know, completely white for, well, miles and miles inland and up the coast. And obviously they're growing fruit and vegetables to import, or they're exporting them around Europe. But yeah, quite a strange part of Spain, that, really. But anyway, Pascal Ackermann off to a good start this season. Meanwhile, over in Italy at the Trofeo Leguaglia, Giulio Ciccone has won there. A big win, really, a big one-day race win for Ciccone. Of course, last year, impressed at the Tour de France and was king of the mountains at the Giro.
He was riding in the Italian national team jersey, wasn't he? I think he was riding for them there. True blue. Ciccone, true blue.
That's right, indeed.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, very good. Very good. Shares a surname with Madonna.
There we go. And then the Buffalo doesn't get that. Anyway, come on.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I get that.
I mean, Daniel, it's not exactly hip to refer to 1980s pop stars, really, is it? I mean, it's not exactly Dave or Stormzy, is it?
What's the Triple Crown? Who can we include a reference to next? We've had Lionel Richie, Madonna. Who would complete the great triumvirate of 1980s pop stars? Maybe Meatloaf.
Goodness. Well, last item of news, the Women's Dubai Tour is ongoing. Opening stage was won by Lucy van der Haar, the British rider. And, well, the racing continues over the rest of the week and the weekend. We've got the Ruta del Sol starting today, the Volta al Algarve, which is also starting today, and then the Tour du Var et des Alpes Maritimes this week, and not long now to Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, which is a week on Saturday, and that's the proper start of the season.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
My name's Owen Doolan, and I ride for Team Ineos. My favourite Science and Sport product is the fruit salad gel. It's refreshing and it's my go-to.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful indeed to them. And you can still get your 25% off all your Science and Sport products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That's SISCP25. Now we were going to turn our attention to a couple of the races, weren't we, Lionel? Tour de la Provence, quite a new race, isn't it? But it's a very, very nice race to watch. Obviously, a beautiful part of the world, and it saw the kind of rebirth, if you like, of Nairo Man in Arkea Samsic colours. Do you have a wee recap of the race there, actually, Lionel?
Indeed, yeah. Well, you mentioned it's a new race. It started in 2016, first won by Thomas Vokler, which seems like ages and ages ago, but just 4 years ago now. And, well, our colleague Jeremy Whittle, I saw a tweet in which he referred to the Tour de la Provence as the hipster's Paris-Nice. And I kind of agree with that, really. It's Paris-Nice with all the kind of the boring cold stages taken out. 4 days in a nice part of France, a couple of really interesting stages.
A great field.
It's like a fab ice lolly without the rubbishy bread bit at the bottom. Only the top two layers, the good bits. Yeah.
Another 1980s reference, Daniel. You really, you're nailing these today. Yeah, well, stage one was livened up by a break. Charlie Quarterman, who making, well, it's not actually his first race because he's already raced for Trek Segafredo at the Étoile de Bessèges, but made an impact in getting in the break, ended the day with two jerseys, the King of the Mountain jersey and the Young Riders jersey. Before Christmas, I went and met Flavio Zappi, who runs the Zappi team. And Charlie Quarterman's dad, Paul, came along. So if you want to find out a little bit more about the man who runs the team that kind of helped Charlie Quarterman on his way to the World Tour level, check out that episode. It's called Meet Flavio Zappi from a few weeks ago now. But yeah, as you say, Arkea Samsic had a fantastic few days. Nasser Bouhanni won again, taking the opening stage. And Quintana won at Chalet Reynard, which is sort of halfway up Mont Ventoux to take the overall lead and close that out, you know, quite comfortably on the final day, which was won by Owain Doull, giving Ineos their first victory of 2020. The race was also Thibaut Pinot's first back in action after he abandoned the Tour de France last July on the infamous Stage 19 with knee trouble. Pinot finished seventh, so sort of spring-like green shoots of recovery for the Française des Jeux leader. But the thing that struck me about Quintana was he looked like a new man. I mean, he pedalled more dynamically, he looked slimmer. I don't know whether that's because the Arkea Samsic jersey is a sort of it's almost a knockoff Ineos jersey, isn't it? A slightly paler red fading into a nice slimming black at the bottom. And Quintana was flying, he was flying up Mont Ventoux, wasn't he, Daniel? Yeah.
He went like a bat out of hell.
He went like a bat out of hell.
Mont Ventoux.
Didn't he, Lionel?
Oh, there's an echo.
There we go.
Oh, there's your meatloaf reference, listeners.
Lovely assist. Napalm. But
but I mean, Nairo Man, it was also we haven't really seen him. You've talked a lot, Daniel, about the great misunderstanding of Nairo Man as a dynamic climber, attacking climber, when actually he's a bit more of a diesel. And here was a different Nairo Man. He was set up by his team quite well. They do seem to, they've got off to a good start, haven't they, that team? And there seems to be good morale in that team. And you know, you could say Quintana and Bouhanni fall into the same category in a way of riders who perhaps haven't achieved their potential, and it looks as if they both have a new lease of life in that team.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things going on just from the outside. I mean, none of us is you know, especially close to the team yet at this point. But there seems to be a sort of mutual flattery, which is having a very positive effect, in the sense that Arkea Samsic almost flattered that Nigel Mann has chosen them, and he's flattered at how flattered they are. And you know, there's a sort of nobility about Quintana as well that you know, I've seen some of the comments he's made about how the French fans have always interacted with him, and he seems to be taking his sort of ambassadorial role very seriously, as he would. I mean, he's that kind of guy. I mean, you see him sort of espousing various causes, you know, domestic abuse. He's or violence against women. He's espoused that cause. He's espoused various other causes on social media. So you know, he takes that kind of thing very seriously. And as you say, Rich, you know, they rode very well, particularly on Mont Ventoux. They've got enough firepower in a race like the Tour of Provence with guys like Wiener Anacona and Barguil as well. Did a little turn, didn't he, on the front. So, yeah, all looking good for them. There could potentially have been one sour note for Arkea Samsic last week. The main sort of champion, or the guy who was sort of seen as the main champion of cycling and the cycling sponsorship in the Arkea company. Arkea is a bank, a Breton bank. The team is a very Breton team. Anyway, this chap, his name is Ronan Le Moal. He announced last week that he was leaving the company, and there was some alarm over whether this might put the team's future in jeopardy, but they've been very quick to sort of quash any suggestion that that might be the case.
I mean, we shouldn't overdo, you know, the Quintana. I mean, it shouldn't do him down too much, but he did have, until stage 18 of last year's Tour de France, he did have a pretty disappointing tour. It was an impressive win at Valois, wasn't it? A long stage where he kind of pulled quite a bit of time out of everybody, but he did so because no one was really that concerned about, you know, closing him back down, because he'd slipped to, well, he slipped out outside the top 10, and that stage win hauled him back into the top 10. I suppose the sort of dynamic Nairo that we saw very early in the Vuelta, the stage win in Calpe, where he really sort of clipped off the front, almost a sort of classic stage win, a sort of Milan San Remo-esque type escape on the descent and run into town. That was pretty dynamic. But I was just struck by just how comfortable he looked, and how twiddly his legs were climbing up the lower slopes of Mont Ventoux. I would just say that again, without getting carried away, you know, it's not suddenly a performance that puts him back on the radar as a Grand Tour winner, you know, this season, I don't think, because, you know, people comparing the climbing speeds on Mont Ventoux.
We'll get to that, Napalm. I mean, I've got something to say about that.
Well,
anyway,
should we get to it now? Because, I mean, it, you know, it really is like comparing, you know, apples and oranges, isn't it? Riding halfway up Mont Ventoux is not the same as riding all the way up to the top.
Well, you know, at the risk of criticising and upsetting some of our colleagues, there were some websites that went with headlines along the lines of, well, not along the lines of, they literally said Quintana breaks the record on Mont Ventoux. Well, a few things on that. I mean, Chalet Reynard is sort of 7 kilometres short of the summit. I don't think that people had even counted some of the times that Paris-Nice has been to Chalet Reynard and then gone down one of the roads to towards the east. But, you know, just in general, when people talk about climbing times and climbing records, In a 200-metre or 100-metre sprint in track and field, a 2-metre-per-second wind, which is 7.2 kilometres an hour, will invalidate a record. The average wind speed in Carpentras, which is the town at the bottom of Mont Ventoux, is 16.7 kilometres per hour in February. So, you know, pretty much all of the time, by the sort of track and field standards, any time would be invalidated. And you're talking about the climb up to Chalet Reynard is 15.5 kilometres, not 100 metres. And plus you add in the 125 kilometres they'd done before they get to the bottom of the climb, when the wind was also having an effect. So, you know, to make these like-for-like comparisons in any circumstances is slightly ridiculous, particularly in a place as notoriously windy as the Rhone Valley. And Mont Ventoux. I mean, the clue's in the name.
Yeah, I think that's right, Daniel. I mean, as a test climb for, you know, historical comparisons goes, Mont Ventoux is about the least suited anyway. And only going halfway up is, well, I mean, like I say, it's like me claiming that I've completed a 147 break at snooker when, you know, I've only potted four of the reds.
All right, Willie Thorne. Well, and that's enough snooker for this episode. Another good 80s reference there. Could have been worse, Lionel. I might have said Bill Werbenick. What was his name? Bill
Werbenick.
Werbenick, yeah. He had 15 pints of lager every game, didn't he?
He had a special dispensation to allow him to carry on drinking after the alcohol ban in snooker, I believe. Yeah.
And then he moved on to beta blockers, I think. A few other kind of loose threads from Tour de la Provence. You mentioned Pinot. I think he was a little bit disappointed with the level of his performance there. David Gaudu just behind him.
I've been keeping an eye on Pinot on Strava, and he's pretty much done the same training or the same amount of time at altitude as he did last year in training, but he also had another block at altitude. I don't know whether he was on holiday, but at Tignes over around about Christmas time. He's probably spent more time at altitude than, you know, at sea level in the last 3 or 4 months, which can have negative as well as positive effects in the short term. So I'm sure he won't be too worried.
Another performance that caught my eye, Domenico Pozzovivo, okay, 14th, but here's a guy whose career may well have been over. We thought it was over. He was hit by a car, suffered terrible injuries towards the end of last year, out of contract, picked up by NTT, formerly Dimension Data. And I think that's a sign that he is back to good health. And that team is going pretty well, NTT. Another performance, someone was disappointed in his performance was Pavel Sivakov, Team Ineos rider with big ambitions this year. He feels like he's maybe lost too much weight. He rode well at the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Race a few weeks ago, but when it got to the climbing, he didn't feel like he had it. He's been trained by Tim Kerrison this year. He was trained previously by Javier Artecha, the Basque coach at Team Ineos, but he's moved to Tim Kerrison, who also looks after Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas, of course.
His teammate, though, Eddie Dunbar, probably pretty happy with sixth place overall.
Probably February, probably the only time of year that's safe for Eddie Dunbar to ride on the Mont Ventoux. I'm always very, very struck by how white his legs are. I always worry about him. Maybe it's because he's taking all the necessary precautions. He's caked in sunscreen that he's so white. But because Carpentras, of course, is the hottest town in France. They broke records last year. 44.3 degrees, hottest temperature ever recorded in France.
Wow. Well, another team going well. Astana, who had a very good opening to last season, placing two men on the podium. Alexander Vlasov won a stage as well, the other hilly stage at La Ciotat, and Alexei Lutsenko in third place. Obviously, Lutsenko has been in the news recently, paired up with Jakob Fuglsang in the allegations about Dr. Michele Ferrari, wasn't he?
Well, we covered that in the week that you were absent in Slovenia, Lionel, and then we didn't actually mention the following week because the story seemed to sort of die as quickly as it came to life. The Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation, CADF, put out a release saying that they had acted on tip-offs or intelligence and found that, well, in their view, there was no case to answer. So the story appears to have gone away. I'm not sure if it will resurface, but, you know, for a few days, it was red hot, wasn't it?
Meanwhile, we've not yet seen Jakob Fuglsang, have we? Or we hadn't until today. He's starting his season at the Ruta del Sol, the Vuelta a Andalucía.
Well, it's nearly time to switch our discussion to the Tour Colombia, but before doing that, mention for Hugh Carthy of EF Education First, who finished fourth in the Tour de la Provence, going as well as his teammates who were competing over in Colombia, because EF took all three places on the podium after really crushing the opening team time trial by 45 seconds. And there were stage wins for Sergio Higuita, who won overall ahead of Daniel Martinez, who also won a stage. It's a real kind of not far from a climbing clean sweep for EF Education First. And on the flat, Juan Sebastian Milano of UAE Team Emirates, well, he got the better of Alvaro Hodge two, three times, winning. I think Hodge was his closest challenger on two occasions, but Milano won three, all three of the flat stages. And well, from the very, very little I saw online, the Columbia Tour seems to be, you know, making a claim to be the most popular stage race in the world in terms of the size of the crowds that come out to watch. Anyway.
Yeah, I saw a fair bit of the Tour of Colombia, napalm, and as you say, you know, the crowds are, I mean, people have compared them to the Tour de France. I actually think that in a lot of cases, they're probably more raucous and even more numerous, certainly on some stages. Certainly the crowds were three, four, five deep in places at the roadside. And yeah, it leads to a fantastic spectacle. And of course, you know, the great thing about Colombian cycling at the moment is that the attention is not focused on just sort of one superstar. There are so many, they're spoilt for choice. And I was sort of trying to get a handle on whether there was sort of one favourite above all of the others, because I think, as we mentioned last week, the race was visiting quite a lot of either where the some of the top riders train or where they were born or where they live. The final stage started from Egan Bernal's hometown, but yeah, the support seems to be fairly evenly shared. And EF Education, you know, had this fantastic week when they almost completed a clean sweep of the classifications and the jerseys, and won the team time trial and won the overall and then won the final stage. And they certainly sort of were the team of the moment. And
well, you say EF were the team of the moment. I mean, Colombia is the country of the moment, isn't it? I've been indulging in some pretty wild speculation here. I mean, every now and again, somebody will suggest the idea of the Tour de France reverting to national teams, and it's obviously a complete non-starter and won't happen. But if it did, Colombia would surely be the strongest team in the world for a Grand Tour. I mean, they've got five leaders: Bernal, Quintana, Lopez, Urán and Chávez. They've got three super mountain domestiques: Sosa, Martinez and Higuita. They've got two sprinters: Gaviria and Hodge. Well, and you could also have Betancourt, Enao, Milano and many others on the reserve list. Hodge and Gaviria wouldn't have any lead out train to speak of, and it unclear who would work for who in the mountains. But it's an amazing depth of talent that really you would associate long gone eras in cycling, you know, the French, the Italians, the Spaniards having that sort of strength in depth. But I can't think of a country that can come close to that sort of, you know, a dozen riders who, you know, would make the strongest Tour de France team possible.
I mean, if Scotland were to put together a team for the Tour de France, it would be Ali Hodge, Teo Gegenhart at stretch, or already stretching, Dario Cioni did a term at Strathclyde University.
And I think, Richard, you'd have to shave your legs.
Yeah, I'd probably
and
have to get
up
back on the bike again, I guess, reluctantly, to ride the Tour de France. Yeah, I mean, that Colombia team looks pretty strong on paper, but unbalanced, I would say. I mean, there aren't many kind of rulers there. If they went over the cobbles one day, I think they could be in a spot of bother. They've got great sprinters and great climbers. Not a lot else, really. Would that be fair?
Well, certainly in the riders that I've listed there, yeah. But you know, it's going to be the most dynamic tour team ever. So they're not going to need any rulers. They're just going to attack
true,
one
yeah.
after the other in the mountains.
Yeah. No.
I mean, you say that it's predominantly climbers, which it is, of course, and Higuita won this race by virtue of his climbing, really. But he's a bit different in the sense that he's very explosive. He sort of models himself when he's asked. He sort of says his idol, as far as cycling is concerned, is Alejandro Valverde, which may not go down that well with everyone, but stylistically, obviously he means he's very quick. He spent a lot of time, I gather that between the ages of about 13 and 17, he raced mainly on the track, or he raced a lot on the track. And he still does a lot of work to sort of preserve the natural speed that he does have. And I mean, he's talked in the past about wanting to win sort of conspicuous, the Tour de France is conspicuous through its absence when he talks about his sort of future dreams. He talks about the Giro and the Vuelta, but I'm not sure what his ceiling is in Grand Tours. I mean, just sort of stature wise, he really is in the matchbox category. He's quite a bit smaller than Quintana. He's 3 or 4 centimeters smaller than Quintana, 4 or 5 kilos lighter. He's sort of in the Pozzovivo category, same weight as Pozzovivo, 2 centimeters shorter. The sort of King Kenny Elizonde is another one, sort of low 50 kilo riders. The only one who I can think of in the last sort of 20 or 30 years who's actually come close to winning a Grand Tour who was quite that sort of small, that diminutive, was Jose Rujano, the Venezuelan rider in 2005. He was even lighter than Higuita, about 3 or 4 kilos lighter than Higuita.
Another rider who did quite well there, Jonathan Restrepo, who's a Colombian who he was at Katusha as a very young rider and then found himself a little bit on the scrap heap, and lo and behold, he's popped up at Androni Giocattoli. He's still only 25, but he was up there in the sprints. He's another different kind of rider. I'm not suggesting that he's going to become a great star, but he was third on a stage, fourth, fifth. He's quite a powerful, you know, rider, a bit bigger. He might do a job for them in the flat stages, perhaps, in this imaginary Tour de France team.
I should say, Rich, just on Higuita, I said he's not talked about aspiring to one day win the Tour de France, but I think he is going to make his Tour de France debut in the summer. And, you know, there'll be a lot of opportunities for a guy like that who climbs well and who finishes as fast as he does. Someone like that is always going to pick up a lot of wins, I would suggest.
I think we can probably hear from some of the EF contingent, can we not, Lionel?
We can indeed, yeah. We'll hear first from Juan Manuel Garate, the sports director of EF Education First, and then from Lawson Craddock, who talks in particular about the stresses and strains of a race that's contested at a pretty high altitude. In fact, it never drops beneath 2,500 metres altitude all week. So first, Garate, and then Lawson Craddock.
We had really high expectations for the team time trial. We won last year's team time trial and we wanted to repeat it this year. So that's why we bring there a really competitive team and in a good shape and with really good material. We prepare really good the race. I mean, we did some efforts the days before and we saw the parcours a couple of times. And the same day we did the 2 laps again, also in the morning. And we adjust all the small details to try to do the best possible performance. And at the race, when we started really fast. And it was a tailwind, and I think that we were maybe riding too fast because the second part of the team time trial was headwind and heading up the first time, and the first part, sorry. And I tried to calm down a little bit the boys, but they continue with the same pace. And the way back, I think Danny and Caicedo, they did like 2 kilometers impressive against the wind until the downhill started. And then, we lost Rigo just a couple of 100 meters before the downhill start. And we arrived with 5 riders till the end. And I was really surprised about the gap that we had with comparing with Ineos or Quickstep, the strongest teams there. And a super surprise. I mean, it was a big surprise not only for me, for everyone, and also for the other teams. I mean, to be 45 seconds in front of Quickstep is impressive in a team time trial of only 16.7 kilometers. So I think it was the best way to start of course, to Colombia. I mean, considering that we had only six riders there, every team had six riders, so to control the race with such a small team, like only six riders, and I wanted to have three for the GC, so that means that I had to use only the other three riders. So I had to think how to use them in the best way to try to be conservative with at least one of them. So the hardest work was only for two riders for the rest of the week. So this is really difficult to work like this. And at the same time, when you arrive with 45 seconds, that means that the race is really open. Right, so everybody was trying to attack and to try to be in the break, and also the strongest teams they tried to make us tired, and they attack all the time, and with really big names since the stage number three, like Bernal and Sevilla. These guys, they were in the breaks, and yeah, if we had only a couple of seconds in front after the TTT, maybe the race was more quiet. But the fact that we had that gap, yeah, opened the race totally.
I mean, first of all, Colombia is just such an incredible country. As cyclists, we really won't experience a culture like that anywhere else in the world. And I mean, I think that could be said about any individual place, but, you know, just the overall ambiance, the atmosphere, the passion from everyone and everything that you experience there is bar none to anywhere else in the world. So I think that adds a pretty epic aspect to the race. Obviously a lot of draw from us to go there, but also the race itself it's tough. I think the minimum we were at was like 2,600 meters, which is just insane. And so that obviously adds a huge challenge to the race, and a pretty big advantage for the guys that are from there. You know that any climb in Colombia is going to be incredible. Before we even hit it, we kind of went up this side street in the outskirts of Bogota, and it was one of the most chaotic and beautiful moments of the entire race. You know, people just screaming, and just thousands of people packed onto this tiny road that was, you know, 600 meters long. And I think that was a pretty good indicator of what the final climb was going to be like. And you know, you're just going through, you know, wave after wave of people who, for whatever reason, know the smaller guy on the team, the guy, you know, that's not even from their Texan that just happens to race with some pretty high level Colombians, and they're all yelling your name, and you know, you're kind of like, wow, this is crazy. Like, why do they know who I am? And I mean, that's pretty cool. Especially for a guy like me, and just the fact that, you know, as the climb goes on, you kind of pick up on what's going on in the race, and you hear a lot of, oh, Higuita, Martinez, and so then you start thinking, like, shit, what happened, you know, and then you hear, Campeono de Higuita, and you're just, wow, this is insane, and then, you know, all the pain in your body goes away, you start celebrating with the crowd for the last couple K, and you know, that's the stuff that really sticks with you. And especially in this sport, where so much of your time is spent just suffering. You know, what I take from these races is those moments where, you know, you're one with the crowd and one with the fans of the sport. And at that point, you kind of become a fan yourself.
Well, chaps, you'll be excited to learn that tickets have gone on sale for our American shows. The Robbie Williams shows with myself and Ian Boswell in New York on April the 8th at the Rafa store in New York, and in Washington DC on April the 9th. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and you'll see how to get tickets for those two events. Should be good fun. Tickets are selling well already, so act quickly.
Really sure to sell to out, that. Though. Sure to what? Sell out. I mean, people are coming from far and wide in the States to see you, aren't they? By the sounds of it,
Washington is close to selling out. We might actually add a second night in Washington.
They were until we mentioned Meatloaf. Fortunately, we didn't mention his political leanings, did we? But anyway,
Well, we'll no, we didn't. I'll be flying the cycling podcast flag with Ian Boswell in New York and Washington. He's never been to New York or Washington, so that'll be interesting. He's also doing a ride, I think, in New York, which will be from the Rafa Cafe on the Wednesday morning. So contact Rafa if you're interested in joining him on the ride.
Coming to America, Richard. Coming to America, the final of our 1980s cultural references.
Yeah. What was the cultural reference there, sorry?
Coming to America. It's an Eddie Murphy film. A film. Something you go to the cinema to watch, starring it.
Oh, I thought you were going... Yeah, I thought you were maybe going to break into song with a Proclaimers, famous Proclaimers number. When you go to America, will you? When you go, will you send back a letter from America?
Oh, yeah, could you?
Well, can you sing it?
No, certainly not.
If you sing it, I'll do it. Another but this ties in with Stacey Snyder, who made the beautiful cups that we sold for good causes during last year's Grand Tours. Hoping to do that again this year. Stacey is definitely coming to the Washington show, but. I got an email from Matthew Ball from the West Lothian Cycle Circuit, which is one of the good causes that we supported through the sale of the cups. Now, they've launched a crowdfunder. They're trying to raise £30,000 in 30 days, and they've actually made a really good start. That will be enough to buy 27 floodlights at £1,185 each. But go to westlothiancyclecircuit.org. For more information, that's their website. They're on Twitter, Facebook, and Crowdfunder as well. crowdfunder.co.uk/letsbuildit. But good to hear that that project is still progressing. So excellent news and good luck to West Lothian Cycle Circuit. We will be picking good causes to benefit from the sale of cups during this year's Grand Tours. We'll have more details a bit closer to the Giro. Any other business this week, chaps?
Just something I noticed, Rich, looking ahead to the races, the stage races happening or starting today, Algarve and Ruta del Sol. We're seeing the first evidence of this new UCI rule whereby World Tour teams with continental division sort of feeder development teams are allowed to slot in members of the continental division team to the main team. So effectively, the old stagiaire period used to run from the 1st of August to the end of the season, when the top teams could try out, sort of have riders on trial. They can effectively do that with riders from their own nursery team throughout the season now. And I said, well, we'll see it in action for the first time this weekend. La Française des Jeux, or Groupama FDJ, are debuting, trialing Jake Stewart, who is one of their British rider. Well, their British rider from the Continental Division team. He's a sprinter, I believe, and Yvonne Madio, who's one of the director sportifs at Groupama, has been talking about the fact that he thinks that Stewart is ready to even, you know, possibly get a result in Algarve.
Is this, I mean, a couple of years ago, the UCI tried to introduce a rule that would compel World Tour teams to have development teams. It didn't seem to go anywhere. But is this rule, do you think, designed to stimulate that idea that, or to promote the fact that, you know, that World Tour teams have a sort of responsibility to development and to encourage them to put some kind of pressure on them to set up development teams?
I would say so, Rich. I think it's also going to be very handy, particularly towards the end of the season, for a lot of these teams, because as we've seen in the past, there are teams when you get towards September, October, who simply struggle to fill places in some races. So I think we'll see a lot of these riders being used towards the end of the season. You can have a maximum of four at a time, four from your development team in the main team in category one races, so that's 2.1 or 1.1 races, and a maximum of two at a time in what the UCI is calling the Pro Series, which is the tier below the World Tour.
Well, I'm watching Ruta del Sol stage one here. Mikel Landa on the attack in his new Bahrain McLaren colours. It's interesting because in other sports, I'm thinking of football in particular, sometimes you'll get a player who makes really fast progress and moves up from you know, into the first team at a young age. And I guess with what's happening in cycling with younger riders performing really well, there could be some surprises. There could be opportunities for young riders to come into the senior team and really do something.
Yeah, I think that the teams, the UCI and the race organisers, if they were all on the same page regarding the calendar and the development of riders and the best use of resources, could put their heads together and really come up with a system that works for the benefit of everyone, the race organisers, the broadcasters, the fans watching, so that they know that there's some kind of context to everything that they're watching, rather than a sort of wall-to-wall of races that are really divided from one another by the TV coverage. So, you know, the perception of one race, you know, a race gains importance if it's got good TV coverage and good scenery, frankly, doesn't it? I mean, they're the two of the three categories that make a good race. The third is having a strong field. And I think that if it weren't for the kind of the ongoing disputes and battles between the teams and the UCI, that some real progress could be made, because some of the ideas are there. This idea of having, you know, feeder teams, but also feeder races, where a tier of stage races are all, you know, leading towards qualification for the big events. And I mean, we've talked about this so many times in the past. The RAFA roadmap that came out a while ago tried to kind of redraw the boundaries of absolutely everything in the road racing calendar. But the more that I look at this kind of month or so before I joke about the real season starting with Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, but it's a joke that's grounded in an element of truth, because everything here is happening, and it does serve a purpose for the riders and for the teams and for the media, but there's kind of no definition to it. It's just lots of people racing in different places, and you know, I suppose whetting the appetite for the events that are to come, and maybe at some point somebody will sit down and work out a way to create some kind of coherent early season format that takes us directly to the classics and the stage races.
Update on the Ruta del Sol. Jakob Fuglsang, who we talked about earlier and won this race last year, didn't he? He has got across to Mikel Landa, so the two of them are going clear on quite a big climb with about 10 kilometres to go to the finish.
Are we going to do live updates as we...
No, just a little update there. As the race unfolds.
Tune in next week to find out who won this race.
Well, yeah, I mean, probably.
Stop press. Jakob Fuglsang won stage one of the Ruta del Sol ahead of Mikel Landa. We will recap the rest of the race and the other races going on this week in next week's episode of the Cycling Podcast.
Anything else? Anything else this week?
Not really, chaps. Been doing any? We talked last week, didn't we, about your cycling? Been doing any, Rich?
Yeah, I went cycling this morning. I went out this morning on the roads around northern France. Did a tough 40 kilometers.
The roads around northern
felt
France.
Pretty hard.
Big old
just
ride.
Just covered northern France. Yeah. I did northern France this morning. But that's about it, actually, in as far as my training goes. Well, I'm going to Het Nieuwsblad next week. And Kern and Brussels Kern. And I'm going to Milan San Remo, but I'd booked to go a bit earlier to see Tom Dumoulin after Tirreno Adriatico. I booked my flight, and no sooner, I mean, it was literally a couple of hours later than that I heard that he had pulled out of Milan San Remo and Tirreno Adriatico. So won't be seeing him there, so I'll have to improvise.
Do you know what? I think he's done that before to us, and in particular me. I think I had an appointment to see him once at Milan San Remo, and he cancelled. I'm pretty sure 3 or 4 years ago.
I also had an interview lined up with him at a training camp, and I'd gone there especially in Calpe to do it. But it was the day of the terrible crash involving his teammates, including Warren Barguil, Chad Haga, John Degenkolb, and so understandably he was a bit shaken up, and we didn't do the interview. So yeah, got a bit of history there with Tom Dumoulin, but hoping to catch up with him at some point, because I'm really interested to hear about how he's fitting into that team, Jumbo-Visma, and how it's going to work at the Tour de France, and also the state of his health. Obviously not been great so far. And, you know, we talked a lot about them naming their team for the Tour so early. And you mentioned Stephen Kruijswijk earlier. You know, things can change, can't they? And Dumoulin's already kind of on the back foot. Early doors, though. But anyway, we should wrap things up for this week. Do become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thanks everyone who has become a friend of the podcast. Explorer will be out soon, won't it, Lionel? First monthly episode of that.
It will, yeah.
We're saving that for now.
Yeah, the Explorer. We've got an episode of Service Course coming shortly as well, haven't we, with Tom and Lizzie we'll be working on. Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton series continues. Two episodes online already. A third will be released next Wednesday. What else? So, well, and then the proper racing, the real racing gets underway. We'll be guessing who's going to win Omloop Het Nieuwsblad in next week's episode, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what we're doing, among other things. Well, that's all for now. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
And before we go, a big thank you to some of you who've signed up as a friend of the podcast. From me, big thanks to John Edwards, Amit Bargava, Andy Lambeth, David Coletto, Chris Pape, Jack McKillop, Dominic White, Jonathan Dalton, Martin Smith, and Jem Brown.
And from me to, and from us indeed, to Scott Wilson, Dennis Trezenrita, Paul Zugamelli, I'm going to say in Italian, Zugamelli, could be something completely different. Louise Gelling.
Oh, I would say Gelling.
Yeah. Ian Godber, Adam Law, Gantry Griffin, Goran Josipovic, Tom Lockerbie, Michael Green.
I think you got Michael Green right, Daniel. Well done. And a big thank you to Toby Wilson, Donald Malone, Casey Cesari, Dave Hodgson, Liam Burgin, Mark Taggart, Martin Campbell, David Sargent, Adrian Gibbons, and Austin Bodie. Thank you very much for signing up as friends of the podcast. We really appreciate it.
I would say Liam Bergen, but never mind. Thanks very much, Lionel. Thanks, Daniel.